Welcome both of you, Hillary and Heidi. You're both H names, and I might a little bit confused, but we'll try to keep it. Your palms are both very different, so that should be helpful. So thank you for joining us for Dialogue Out Loud. My name is Teresa Wellborn, Dialogue's poetry editor and lover of the written and spoken word. Founded in 1966, Dialogue is the oldest independent journal of Mormonism, publishing scholarship, poetry, art, and fiction on the Latter-day Saint experience. Today, we are in conversation with our poets from the 2024 summer issue, Heidi Naylor and Hillary Brown. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So by way of introduction, we usually start with the bio. So I'll start off with Heidi. So Heidi Naylor is the author of The Story Collection Revolver, finalist for the Association for the Mormon Letters Award for Short Fiction. She teaches writing and literature at Boise State University, has a recent fellowship with the Idaho Commission on the Arts, and served as a writer in residence for poetry at the Marion Pritchett Memorial School. Yes. And then going over to Hillary. Hillary Brown, she was born in Salt Lake City. She graduated from USU, as locals call it, Utah State University, and is a proud public school teacher in a border town. Her current project, which is very intriguing to myself, is a memoir written in verse detailing her personal experiences with scrupulosity, which we'll talk about a little bit later, I hope. Hillary lives in Arizona with her husband and with her daughter, Audrey. Welcome, both of you.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. So so as we do our format, I just like to ask usually a question to one of you, and then we have a conversation and then a question to the other. So I'll start out with Heidi, first of all. Who are your literary influences?
My favorite writer who I love to talk about is Alice Munro, who unfortunately we lost on the 13th of this month. She won the Nobel Prize in Literature in 2013. She's a Canadian writer of short stories. And I think she is just amazing. I call her the goddess. And she is my favorite writer. But I also, I've been just really into poetry for the last two and a half years. So I have some favorite poets. Maggie Smith, Mary Gordon, Richard Sykin, Stanley Plumley. I've been getting into his poetry lately. Linda Gregg, favorite Idaho poet, Carrie Webster. And so, and I enjoy the Mormon poets, Carol Lynn Pearson. And Hillary, I enjoyed your poem so much. I have a book called, I'm looking at it now, Discoveries, Two Centuries of Poems by Mormon Women, and I've been making my way through that, and it's super fun. So I'm just kind of an eclectic reader, voracious reader, and lover of language.
Lovely. Okay. I love that you mentioned Maggie Smith. Her poem, Good Bones, is one of my favorite poems ever. So good.
Yeah,
it's a good one. Okay, wonderful. Jumping over to Hillary, tell us about your journey to becoming a writer / poet.
Oh, I thought you were going to ask me the same question. I was all ready. I was like, oh, I got to hear the question first and think about it.
Well,
well, I had an English teacher in high school who was my creative writing teacher, and I had ended up in that class because I was failing the other elective. And anyway, so I was not doing well in school, but so moving into that creative writing class was the first time that I felt like I had had a voice in school. And so that was my introduction to that feeling. And I, that class was really focused on poetry, and I just fell in love with that way of expressing myself. And so I've been doing that since high school. My mother loves poetry, and she's not a writer herself, but she's just extremely well read, and she loved poets like Edna St. Vincent Millay. Like, she was very into poets who had understood like form and meaning. She had a great respect for like the craft. So that was a huge influence to me. And I teach high school now here in Elon. So I would like to say that I wrote every day now, but that is not the case. I'm mostly working with other people's writing and teaching, but it's still, I think, a fundamental way that I see the world and engage with the world.
That's awesome. That's so cool. I like how you said engaging with the world, and that's maybe like the lens that you use, one of the lenses you use to see the world. And I don't want to speak for Heidi, but I get a feeling that that's kind of brought us together tonight. So let's see. Oh, I also like that you talked about voice. Voice is so important. And sometimes in the LDS realm, I know there's been some movements and some discussions over periods of years about women's voices maybe in the LDS church, you know, like, are we heard? Are we seen? And I think that writing poetry, even though it might not be as mainstream as it could be, it's another way, right, that we can get our voice into the mix. And I'm so grateful for dialogue that it allows that platform for voices such as your own, both of you and others, to be out there. So cool. So let's go back to Heidi. Would you mind sharing your poem with us? Do you have it? Okay.
I'd love to. Thank you. My poem is called Newborn. Tell us the dream where you entered the mountain and left all your gold for the dawn. How you dropped your robes of light become smoke and slipped off the worn shoes of the pilgrim. You redacted the text of your spirit, permitting its vapor to rise, keeping only the crystalline salt of your soul. Then stepped into a small, perfect skin and greeted us as though we had something to teach you.
I've got to tell both of you, when I read both of your poems independent of one another, I thought, who are these ladies? Who are they? I really can't wait to meet them. So I'm just, and I also just get geeked out about poetry, especially when it's really well written. So I just want to applaud both of you. Okay, Heidi, so let's talk. I love that you redacted. Redacted is a gravitas, right? It has some weight to it. Tell us more about the words you chose and some of your feeling behind the poem, if you don't mind.
Well, I am a besotted grandmother, and I have two small granddaughters. And when I wrote this poem, both of these little girls live in Alaska. I live in Idaho, so I don't get to see them nearly as much as I would like to. Thank heaven for FaceTime and airplanes. But I was visiting when this little girl, it's my second little granddaughter, was born. And I was visiting, and she was just a couple of weeks old. And there's just nothing quite like holding a newborn baby. And I was holding her, and I just got this kind of breathtaking sense that this is a fully formed human being with a divine spark. She's got a beautiful soul and a spirit that I could feel. We have a beautiful doctrine in the LDS church that talks about a pre-mortal life where we were individual, we were unique, we were beloved. And I just got this sense that it, looking into her deep eyes, her deep dark eyes of, who are you? I just want to know you so much, and I love you so deeply. And we think often about, you know, I think we talk often in our culture about, you know, a baby is a blank slate. Look at all this potential. I remember, or we think about the baby in terms of us and what can we do for this baby and how can we teach this person and help them grow. And I remember saying to my younger brother one time when his newborn daughter was born, saying, look at all the mistakes you haven't made. Like, what a wrong perspective. He said, He said, yep, I'll make them. But I looked at, you know, I've evolved, I guess, because I looked at this sweet little person and I just felt the strength of her spirit. And that's kind of what I was trying to capture in the poem.
It's beautiful. Hillary, having read Heidi's poem before, do you have any thoughts you'd like to add on your reading of her poem?
I think you captured exactly what you described. Like, I can feel that spirit as I'm reading it. And I love kind of the turn at the end, like you talked about that overwhelming feeling of I'm supposed to teach you, when you're feeling all of that power from this newborn. So I love the poem. The opening, like, I think the first and last lines were really resonated with me. Let me open it again. I love that you started with tell us. I think that's just such a beautiful thing to say to a newborn. Tell us, like, this idea that they're coming with a story is so exciting. I think that's a beautiful, beautiful invitation to a newborn.
Thank you.
I liked how you used the word pilgrim. Pilgrim, yeah, is imbued with so many thoughts and feelings for so many of us. Pioneer / pilgrim, right? Newcomer. But also someone who has really lived a life and has experienced, which in the realm of the LDS view, right, of preexistence and what has happened before this life is not our physical life here is not the first, you know, iteration of who we are, right? So I love that, the feeling there. And then robes of light. I've been studying light for about 15 years as a kind of a side hobby, hoping maybe it will become a novel at some point. I've never heard of robes of light, like that phrase. I've never considered it. And I love when poets introduce new phrasing to me that helps me reconsider something that I felt like I already knew, you know? So thank you. Yeah. So, all right. That's beautiful. Okay. So now we're going to go over to our other poet, over to Hillary. I'm just shuffling a few pages. Okay. So... tell us more about your, is it, I say Tanka? Is that how you say, is it Tanka or Tonka?
I was saying it Tonka, but.
Hey, you say tomato, I say tomato. Okay.
No, I'm like, let's stop everything and look it up.
No, we're fine, we're good. Tell us more about poetic form, and you are a teacher, so do you teach form, like formal form? And then tell us how that form in your, specifically in your poem, upon finding out the Colorado Springs murder is a Mormon, how that, like, did the form inform you how to write that? Did it fall in? And then are you able to also read your poem to us?
Sure. Which would you like me to do?
Read
it. Okay. Okay. So my poem is called Tonka, Upon Finding Out the Colorado Springs Murder is a Mormon. I could have argued recipes with his mother over funeral potatoes, or watched him fold more than his share of great chairs at a fireside or anyone's baby blessing. I could have nudged him when we told the story of laying down weapons of war. Are you getting this? I could have said. Then again, he could have nudged me when they spoke of musket fire, a prophet's proclamation. He could have asked me the same thing after each hymn, marching as to war, with the cross of Jesus going on before. Yes, well, we've made our choices.
Wow. That is a very impactful poem for me. Before I babble on, though, Hillary, what would you like to share with us some of your thoughts?
Sure. So you asked about the form. So it is an ancient Japanese form, similar to a haiku. It follows the syllabic pattern of 5-7-5-7-7. And I think often when I'm trying to write through grief or something very complicated, that having a tight form helps me to be able to It forces me to choose the exact right word, and to write with clarity. And then also it makes the places where the form breaks really important. So I was thinking about this idea of following traditions. There's a few different traditions mentioned in the poem, and unfortunately, there are hatreds that are also tradition. And so having this tight form and then being able to break it at the end was a way for me to kind of look inward and say, like, when do we fall in line with tradition and when do we break form and make different choices? So as far as your question about if I teach form, I really try to focus with my students on just recognizing the relationship between form and meaning, that form should be serving the meaning, and giving them as many choices as possible as far as in anything that they're writing, that you're the writer and you're making choices based on your purpose and your audience, and there's different forms that can serve different purposes. But always that choice should serve the meaning. And so that does help me when I'm writing to have to choose a form that is going to, I think it forces me to be creative in a different way, but also to tighten it with clarity and to choose words carefully.
Very cool. In reading your poem, much like you said, the importance of like purpose and audience and then recognizing where form and meaning are, I don't feel like you're sacrificing anything to the content, to the form. Mm-hmm. I feel like your content is strong and I feel like it's a really good match, you know, the content with the form.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Heidi, do you have any thoughts you'd like to share on having read the poem prior?
Sure. Thank you for introducing me to the Tunka form. I was counting your syllables and going, oh, this is just so cool. And you even have the song form of Jesus that counts in the syllables. So
yeah,
kudos to you for just rocking that form.
But thank you.
For me, the content is, of course, even more compelling. And there's kind of the hint that our very rich culture and doctrine does teach violence. You use the word hatred, but there is violence in the scriptures, in the Book of Mormon, which you kind of allude to in the poem. And along with that violence is love, mm-hmm. and responsibility for one another. And your poem brings those things too. I could have nudged him. And he could have asked me, and what responsibility do we bear for one another when it comes to interpreting the we like to say the gospel is simple, but it's not always simple. When we have examples, clear examples of violence as the way to go, especially in the Book of Mormon, and I think your poem asks us to interrogate that a little bit, along with the responsibility that we have for one another. Also, the poem brings up the concept of agency in the very end. And my understanding of the Tonka form is that there's a turn or a pivot, kind of like what a sonnet does.
Yes.
And near the end, generally, and your poem makes quite a pivot to, yes, well, we've made our choices. And while we bear some responsibility for one another and what informs those choices, ultimately the agency is ours. And your poem kind of insists on that in the end.
Thank you.
It's lovely. Thank you.
I think it's really cool that, Hillary, that you wrote a poem about death and murder and very hard things, but in a way that's accessible and very thoughtful. and mingle spirituality in with it, which is really life, right? Like there's the violence, like, I don't know, stepping on a spider or, you know, something small like that, or it can be, you know, the death of a larger realm. Along those lines too, I also appreciated in stanza three that you're mentioning musket fire, which to me brings to mind President Holland's more recent talk at BYU, which has really personally affected me in many ways regarding thoughtfulness and how to interpret that. And then Prophet's Proclamation, which I'm interpreting as the proclamation to the family. So there's a lot in there. It's packed. Like what you said, there's a lot going on.
Yes, and I think part of what I was trying to reconcile and deal with in writing this poem is kind of our culture's refusal to say, this is us too, this is part of us. We're very, Mormons as a people are very quick to lay claim to any positive assimilation with, or not affiliation with Mormonism, any celebrity or politician who does something positive, we're very quick to claim them as ours. And I immediately saw the church not claim this person who had done this horrible thing and say, well, but he hadn't gone to church services for a long time. Instead of as a people being able to say, this is part of us too. Like, he was one of ours. He is one of ours. To be able to hold that discomfort and that complication and say, when we have a prophet using the phrase musket fire to then turn around and say, this has nothing to do with us. To me is not okay. And then I think it's okay to engage in the conversation and say, this is part of us. Let's talk about it.
Yeah. I appreciate that, Hillary. You know, in any group of individuals, any religion, any right community or culture, you'll have ups and downs, right? You'll have dark and light, you'll have different shades. And I love how poetry makes the inaccessible more accessible, right? And while there might not be 100% clarity in many things, the older I get, the more I realize there's a lot of shades of gray, but definitely it introduces and invites others to consider points of view they may not have considered before in a different light. And there's something I'd like to share. Lucille Clifton, I don't know if she's one of your favorites, but she wrote a little poem here that makes me think of this Tonka. Child, I tell you now, it was not the animal blood I was hiding from. It was the poet in her, the poet and the terrible story she could tell. And if you let that sit with you for a minute, terrible to me just means the horrid beauty or the beautiful horror, right, of what I see in your Tonka here. So poetry is fun, but it's also sometimes about hard things, right? So I welcome that. I'm grateful. Okay, folks. So now at this point, we're going to pivot and back to Heidi, asking you, do you have a question, Heidi, perhaps for Hillary? And then Hillary, be thinking forward if you would have a question possibly for Heidi as a invitation to converse.
Okay. Okay. A question for you, Hillary. We've already talked about the Tonka as a formal choice, and you spoke, I think, really beautifully about how the constraints of a form can help you maybe get at something that's complicated or get at a particular tension. So what other forms are you exploring in your poetry?
Thank you for that question. I've tried recently working with villanelles. So I wrote one about, again, these really intense topics with these forms, but writing about what it feels like to be a teacher and seeing school shootings in the news. And so I used a villanelle to kind of capture that feeling of repetition. I've used haikus a lot, and sometimes like in series, because I love the idea of having like a turn, almost like a, feels like a door hinge. So those are a couple. There's a poet named Jericho Brown, who wrote a book called Traditions, and he has a form that I played with. He created a new form. Now I'm blanking on the name, so one second. but he's a poet who has inspired me.
He writes some great.
A duplex is what he calls it. Which is he takes some older forms like sonnets and kind of twists it a little bit. So that I played with that new form a little bit. Yeah, thank you for that question. I find just a lot of inspiration in imitating different poets as far as it comes to form, which I think sometimes as writers we're a little bit leery of at times, but I think any artist does that, right? Like imitating and practicing different forms. So that's been inspiring to me.
Well, it's inspiring to me and something that I'd like to try based on what you're doing. What I admire, I think, the most is how you're quite bravely tackling very difficult events. You mentioned that you're a teacher in a border town. I imagine that comes up in your writing. And you're tackling these issues and events through poetry and helping us to a more nuanced understanding.
Thank you. It feels like an important counterpose almost to, like, we have a lot of very fast-paced forms of communication now, and I think that poetry kind of arrests time and like forces us to be careful with our words, careful in the sense of like taking care with each word that we include. And I think it's so needed against like the backdrop of so much fast paced communication. So,
Well said. I agree. Okay, guys. So we're going to move forward. And Hillary, do you have a question for Heidi or any thoughts on?
Sure. Just again, looking back at your poem, I really like the phrase that you used, crystalline salt of your soul, because it just feels so clear. Just this idea of like, I guess my question is, what were you thinking of about the soul? If I can ask like such a specific question, what made you want to describe your, is it your granddaughter?
Yeah.
Your granddaughter's soul in that way.
I'm not sure what I was thinking, but I know that when I was trying to capture this feeling, for me, poetry is so much about emotion and trying to capture and share a feeling and invite a feeling in the reader. And I remember just feeling a strong kind of spiritual sense. And which leads me to, you know, the language of the spirit, which is often scriptural language. And so salt is a very strong symbol in the scriptures, mostly good in good ways, in good and positive ways. And, you know, the Savior asks, or the Savior claims that any adherent, any follower, any disciple are the salt of the earth. So I'm looking at this sweet, powerful person a spirit in a body, in a brand new sparkling body, and thinking of her as the salt that just almost a distilled essence, because she's so new. She's the salt of the world. She's the precious, precious thing that we all needed to survive. We enjoy it. It's important to our mortal experience. So I guess I can't remember exactly what I was thinking, but I know that I had that spiritual sense and was searching for those kind of spiritual images.
So beautiful. Thank you. It makes me want to go back and reread and look for other scriptural symbols and phrases, because that's such a perfect choice. That's beautiful.
Thank you. All right. Thanks to both of you. Thank you so much. Before we close, I'd just like to share a quote from Madeline L'Engle. And I just love, again, the juxtaposition of birth with Heidi's poem and then death with Hillary's. So kind of looking at that circle of life, this quote came to mind. It's by Madeline L'Engle. A self is not something static, tied up in a pretty parcel and handed to the child. Finished and complete, a self is always becoming. And I think also as writers, we're always becoming. I liked how, Hillary, you talked about kind of stepping into maybe the voice of other poets, right? Like using them as examples and ideas, and also stepping into form. And then Heidi, your nods to, different scriptural backgrounds, and just this solemnity and the beauty, intrinsic beauty and value of birth, right? Of newborns and that. So there's doors are opening and shutting, right? With birth and death. And I just, anyway, we're always, always becoming. So I just want to thank our folks out there for joining us. Thank you for listening. Please share this podcast with a friend and check out the entire lineup of excellent podcasts in the Dialogue Podcast Network by visiting us at dialoguejournal.com. Dialogue Out Loud is produced and edited by Daniel Foster Smith, and our executive producers are Emily Jensen and Taylor Petrie. See you next time. Thanks so much. Thank you, Hillary. Thank you, Heidi.
Greetings. My name is Rebecca DeSchweinitz, and I'm thrilled to serve as a board member at the Dialogue Foundation and as one of the hosts of Dialogue Gospel Study. In each episode, which we record live the second and fourth Sunday of every month, we welcome esteemed speakers from a variety of backgrounds to share their insights and perspectives on the Come Follow Me lessons. Our aim is to spark meaningful conversations about the scriptures, to connect them to our personal experiences and to our understandings and explorations of the gospel. To stay in the loop with our upcoming lessons and this opportunity to engage with Mormon thought, culture, and belief, be sure to visit dialoguejournal.com and sign up for our newsletter. By doing so, you'll receive updates and timely links to join our live stream lessons. Additionally, you can catch up on our past guests and episodes by subscribing to Dialogue Journal on YouTube, Facebook, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dialogue Podcast Network.